I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the choreographer Mark Morris. He started the Mark Morris Dance Group in 1980, and its home, the Mark Morris Dance Center, is located in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, in New York City. Mark has choreographed over 130 works for the company since inception and has created productions for opera, ballet, and television. Mark was named a MacArthur Fellow in 1991. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
It's hard to see process when you're seeing a dance performance. It's not like a painting where you've seen drawing underneath or you've seen layers of other ideas that the painter has flirted with or experimented with. So can you talk to me about your process?
Well, first of all, there's an obsession with process that I don't share with other people, in that I don't need to know how the magic trick is done. I want the surprise. Part of that is that I don't show pieces until they're finished. You know, I'm very, very strict about letting people not watch. I am notorious, I don't know why, for covering the windows. If I'm at a studio working on a ballet in another company, I don't let people watch. And, you know, lots of times people on the board or people who give a lot of money to a company are used to having that access. And to me, that makes it a performance. Sometimes I won't actually put the finishing button on something until right before it performs. You know, everyone thinks it's done, and I don't like that. I don't like to watch works in progress. I think you should finish it, and then I'll buy a ticket. Hmm. I don't want to know all of the awful secrets that happen backstage. So anyway, but the answer to what my process is, I almost exclusively start with a piece of music that I love, or at least admire, and can bear to listen to many, 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 many hundreds of times. I work with music that I can travel with because I work exclusively with living musicians. I do not use recorded music. You can, but don't. So I find a piece of music, I study it. You know, I study it on the airplane, reading the music, or thinking, or procrastinating, or getting these earworms that make me nuts. And it's very rarely music that was written specifically to be danced to. I don't do a lot of that because a lot of that is not very interesting.
Earworms? Is that a real thing, by the way? Like when you get a song in your head, is that just what you call them?
No,
or is it a condition?
It's from a German word, the same, you know, Ohrwurm. And it's when something's driving you crazy, a tune driving you crazy in your mind. That's an Ohrwurm.
And is it a condition or is
it
something?
No, it's just an irritation. It's not like a mental disability. I don't get a parking spot for it or anything like that. Every bit of music at some point becomes embedded in a very annoying loop.
So
oh, your far. Hand is so interesting.
Oh, thank you. But I don't show people my process.
No, I can't
I'm
read upside
just
down.
Kidding.
Oh, no, you shouldn't ever.
This is my work. Anyway.
This is my work. This is what mine looks like. And it's always on the legal pad, always with the same pencil because I'm crazy that way. But anyway.
Thank you for showing me your process.
Sure.
But on the subject of coming up with the music first.
I like to surprise myself. I do big orchestra stuff. I do a lot of vocal music. I do modernist music. My favorite centuries are 18 and 20.
So from there, do you then create the actual dance in your mind? Do you map it out on paper before you present it to your dancers? Or is it more like, you know what, as I'm knitting, I'm going to pick up the, you know, the next stitch? Or how does that happen?
I make up everything in the room with my dancers there. I don't work in the studio alone ever. I study the score and I have some ideas, something like, you know, everything has to go from one side of the stage to the other, or this is only for women, or there are no diagonals, or, you know, I have many different rules that I set up in advance to trigger my some kind of an idea spout.
Do your dancers help you come up with ideas?
There's a strange assumption that many people make. I'm not accusing you of it, but you could. That, you know, I get a question very often in Q&A periods after a performance where I'm given this choice. Are you a complete, you know, fascist, tyrant, dictator, or do the dancers improvise? You know, it's like, well, neither. I mean, it's more that I'm a fascist dictator, but the dancers dance. That's they contribute by dancing, not necessarily by improvising. Everybody I work with and anyone I collaborate with, set design, lighting design, costumes, music in a different way, I give those people, the designers who aren't composers, the music that I'm thinking of working on. And then that person listens to the music and comes up with something. Whether it relates to what I had in my head or not doesn't really matter.
So you are hands-off in that regard, more so than I might have assumed.
Well, the final say is mine on all of these things, but I'm certainly not a lighting designer. So you have great power if you're a lighting designer with me because I don't know of anything. You know, I either give things up completely or try to, and, you know, the last say is mine, but I welcome other people's ideas, I think.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the choreographer Mark Morris, founder of the Mark Morris Dance Group located in Brooklyn in New York City. He has created more than 130 works extending from ballet to opera. He has directed or choreographed productions for the Metropolitan Opera, the New York City Opera, the Royal Opera, the San Francisco Ballet, among others. Mark has collaborated with leading artists ranging from the cellist Yo-Yo Ma, the pianist Emmanuel Axe, the dancer Baryshnikov, and the designer Isaac Mizrahi. On the subject of preservation, music preservation, mm-hmm. dance is a challenging one, right? How is dance preserved? I don't really know.
It isn't. That's one thing that's fabulous. It's like you'll never have that same meal again. You know, it's like I went to all this work. I worked all day long to make what I'm serving you for dinner, and you ate it in a second. Hooray. I love that. And that's how I feel about my work. That's why I don't want people to watch me do it, because that's a different kind of show. That's reality TV or something. Before some politician mentioned the Etch-a-Sketch, I used to use that as the perfect system of dance notation. You write it down on this, and then you shake it, and it's gone. You know, like love letters in the sand, you know, that kind of thing. And also, I was the other day, in fact, I said something, I was talking about a choreography of the great Frederick Ashton. I saw a piece recently, and I said to some of my dancers, like, what's, you know, have you ever seen this piece? And several said, of course, well, I watched it on YouTube. It's like, okay, you're right, and you've never seen the piece. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I've seen it, and can watch it on YouTube to remind myself of something, you know, as an aide mémoire. But really, I'm so devoted to the live aspect of theater that that all the participants, the dancers and the musicians and the audience are all living things. If that means I'm a dinosaur, it's true. I don't mind that.
So let's say somebody wants to perform a piece that you created mm-hmm. from 1992. Can they?
Yes. You know, I have notes and, of course, recordings, video recordings that aren't broadcast quality that I use as I don't even look at them usually. There's, you know, I always have an assistant. You know, the dance is a wonderful, still living version of the oral tradition. Dancers teach other dancers mm-hmm. and teachers teach other dancers, and everybody's memory is wrong. And that's true watching a tape. You're missing, of course, the time in between frames if it's a film. And a bunch of other dimensions, mm-hmm. you know, and 3D, all the 3D glasses in the world aren't going to help that. Mm. I already live in 3D. So there are notes in a score, there are videotapes, there are whatever notes that people keep. But the methods, Laba notation, Benesch notation, don't really work. Mm. And there's some brilliant people at the who work for the Laba Notation Bureau who are proving me wrong at this moment. And I want it to be true. I want to be wrong. But it's a difficult, very difficult thing to do.
What's Laba?
Laba notation is a form of writing, of notation, graphic notation that gives every single possible detail of an action, including the dynamics and the timing. And it's incredibly arduous to write it out. And very few people can read it.
Laba yeah. notation is dance language.
Yes.
I want to talk about your collaborations because it seems like you take the best of the best when you are collaborating. For instance, you've collaborated with Yo-Yo Ma a number of times. You worked on an Emmy Award-winning TV film called Falling Downstairs as one such project. Where did this collaboration or this penchant towards collaboration come from? You know, why go to Yo-Yo Ma versus somebody who's not as well-known or...
Well, he's very good. There's that, which is one reason he's really well known. In fact, Mr. Ma is who approached me, first of all. Would I be interested in choreographing one of the unaccompanied cello suites of Bach? And I basically said no, because everybody and his brother has choreographed that music. Or it's fragments of it on a bad recording, probably one of his recordings, but over bad speak. You know, it's like bad speakers. So it's like, And so that's what was interesting to me. It's like, well, no, but sure. Mm. And so we worked together over quite a long stretch of time to make up that dance, which was the first thing that we did as a collaboration. So one thing is that people are attracted to me. Musicians like my work, and I'm happy about that, because the world of music is a much, much bigger one than the little tiny world of dance, which I love, but you see everybody you know pretty soon. You know, it's like a small town. So Emmanuel Axe came to me. He saw a show at Jacob's Pillow at the urging of Mr. Ma, with whom he's played for many, many years, and said something like, I never heard this piece the way I just saw it, kind of something like that. And could we work together? We ended up doing these big Mozart project together. And I have to tell you, this is a sad but fabulous truth, is that people who are really good are easier to work with. Because they're really good and they're confident and they're less looking for some mistake, you know?
And to what extent are these choices strategic, that, of course, if you're going to work with Baryshnikov or Isaac Mizrahi, they're going to be more high profile and they're more marketable?
Well, sure. You know, you don't even get to the end of Mr. Baryshnikov's name and it's sold out. So, you know, Isaac Mizrahi is my best friend. And we were friends before we ever worked together. So, in fact, I was a little worried the first time. You know, it's like, I would love you to design costumes, but what if that means we're not going to be friends anymore because we end up hating working together or something? Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. So, you know, it's like that. Yo-Yo and I are friends. The great, great English painter, Howard Hodgkin, is a very close friend of mine and has done some beautiful work. Well, he always does beautiful work, but he's done some that I've used in my productions. So it's great. And, you know, if you last long enough, which I guess I have because I know so many people and I like them. You know, Peter Sellers is a very good friend of mine and we've worked together many times in the past.
The Metropolitan Opera in New York City.
Mm-hmm, that's one, yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the choreographer, Mark Morris. We'll hear more from Mark coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mark Morris, founder of the Mark Morris Dance Group, located in Brooklyn in New York City. The company's on the road more than 20 weeks a year, producing 75% of the company's revenue. The company charges over $25,000 per performance. Mark is also a conductor for the Mark Morris Dance Group since 2006. I love that. There's like a 360-degree approach to your work, whether it's not just choreographing operas, but directing them, mm-hmm. or not just choreographing the dances, but conducting.
Right. It's scary. But, you know, it's part of me staying interested. It's like, it's not world domination. It's just, it's a big world already, and I like a lot of parts of it that relate to my work.
I want to talk about your early life. What turned you on to dance initially?
My sister, my older sister, was taking dancing lessons. That's maybe where I first caught a glimpse of something. I was very young. And the adorable story about me being like 5 or 6 and jamming my feet into Tupperware orange juice glasses and using them as pointe shoes. Can you imagine? Anyway.
By the way, this was in your biography written by Joan Acacella called Mark Morris.
That's right. Well, I'm citing Joan writing about my history. That's great. Then I saw, the thing I most remember was that I saw a Spanish dance company, the Jose Greco Company, on tour in Seattle. And I asked if I could please learn that kind of dancing. And my mother said, of course.
How old were you?
I was 8 or 9. And she found a wonderful woman who taught Spanish dance in Seattle, and I studied with her for many years. But my house was not full of professional dancers or musicians, but, you know, my father played keyboards and sang, and, you know, we always sang. There was music all the time, and that was a big part of it.
Was your mother at all resistant to her son's wanting to pick up a dance?
No.
What was or what is she like?
Well, she died a few years ago, and she was the greatest possible. She was fabulous. My father died when I was a teenager. And so, you know, a lot of time was just with her and my two sisters who still live in the Seattle area. I could do whatever I wanted. My parents wanted me to be happy and dedicated and curious and interested and smart, and I'm those things.
What are some examples of you doing what you wanted?
Well, it was shocking to me, but I was, you know, as a teenager, I spent weekends away with friends who were older than I was and who were drinking and having sex, et cetera, who were folk dancers. I was very much involved in a folk dance community in Seattle. My most wonderful days were doing line dances and circle dances with live music and singing and drinking and participating with people. Everyone says that my work reminds them of certain folk dance traditions, which is fine with me because I'm not necessarily doing direct quotes. I'm doing the feeling and the spirit and the actual participation that people have when they're dancing together. So you look at somebody actually in the eyes instead of in that direction, and you actually hold hands and you actually are really participating with other people, not just dancing for the viewer.
To what extent was your interest in dance tied to your sexuality, if at all?
When I was about 17 when I spent my last year of high school. I graduated early. I hated school. I left, and I was dancing full-time. Anyway, I went for about almost a year the trip abroad when I was a teenager. I was 17, and I traveled around, and I wrote a letter from Spain admitting that I was queer. And, of course, my mother had known that all along. And, you know, it's like, oh, I just want you to be happy, and et cetera. Like, that might make it harder. Because, of course, this is ancient history now, but when it was against the law in Spain, certainly, to be queer. And I was, you know, in the early days of my company, I was always described as the self-described gay choreographer. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because somebody had to. Everybody was pretending not to be. And, you know, now that's risible because everyone is so free. And I would use finger quotes, but we're on the radio, so you can imagine that I'm saying it with slight sarcasm, that, you know, there's no problem anymore. It's like, that's because, partly because of my contributing to the fight for queer rights that my young gay dancers think just happened automatically.
Your father was a high school teacher,
right,
and a amateur musician.
Right.
Your mother, what did she do?
She did a lot of secretarial stuff. She she worked for the city of Seattle for years and years. Yeah, and then, you know, she was a single mother for a long stretch of that. That's why I started cooking, because she wasn't very good at it, and I loved it.
Mm. What's the last thing you've cooked for dinner?
Oh, I had a big cooking festival this weekend. I made a gigantic 19th century recipe for onion soup, which it takes all day long. It's huge amounts of onion, delicious. And I made a bolognese just for the week, because I like to take my own food.
And you leave your house sometimes with the stove on. As do I, but I do so accidentally, and you do so consciously.
Yeah, it has to simmer.
You also, you never eat standing up, and each each meal you set the table, even if it's just for yourself, and it's a performance for you of one. You're the audience and the performer, and it's
virtual. I'm not watching myself eat. That's horrifying. I like to pay attention to that sort of thing, and most people. You know, you say, how was the ballet? It was pretty, or they could do really hard things. Like, well, that isn't enough. Think a little more and tell me, and who conducted, and what color were her eyes? You know, that kind of thing. Notice, and you have to practice that, or it goes away.
And you are quite resourceful, it seems, in your cooking. You'll come home from a tour and you'll find, you know, leftover chicken that's been sitting there for weeks, and you'll you'll make a meal. What are your thoughts on just your resourcefulness?
I have sort of a gentleman's training idea where I think young men today, particularly young men, need to be able to change a tire and make an omelet and speak a little French and, you know, have some versatility, be able to finish a sentence maybe, you know. And people get so shut off, and especially if you're very protected by growing up in a dance environment, and you're still a, you know, a shrinking violet because it's still naughty to be gay for some of these people. So those things all tied together. I'm resourceful in that I can come up with something. From the empty pantry, I can come up with a wonderful dinner for whoever shows up. And I kind of do that in my work, and I kind of do that on the road. I've been traveling for so many years that I'm sort of unflappable.
Just on the subject of resourcefulness, you said that it comes up in your dance. But what's a real example of that?
Well, one thing is just a pragmatic daily irritation because we tour a lot. We get in maybe the night before. We spend all day, of course, hanging lights and, you know, getting the floor ready and having music rehearsals and sound check and spacing the verb to space in the meaning that dancers use is to adjust what you're doing to where you actually are. So my studio in Brooklyn in Fort Greene, which is great, and I have a giant studio where I can tape out with tape on the floor the size of the theater we're going to go to, it's always different. You know, a diagonal changes its degrees depending on the size of the rectangle, in a theater. And you still have to get there by that point in the music and meet somebody else and have it work smoothly. Also, most theaters are too cold. Mm. A lot of floors are too hard. It's a hard, you know, it's like, oh, poor us, we get to do what we love. But it's also, it's a real vocation. It's a really, it's hard. And dancers have to worry about themselves staying healthy and active and keep track of a lot of information because they have to memorize everything. So, but then all of that is open. All of those ends are untied, and we have to make that work everywhere we go. That's a pragmatic example of the chaos that we have to solve all the time.
You mentioned that you always knew you wanted to be a dancer, but you don't have the traditional body of a dancer. Did that ever...
Well, I'm 56. I'm fat now.
What did you look like?
Gorgeous.
When you were...
I was a great, great dancer. I wasn't just a good dancer. I was a great dancer. But people say that about my company. They don't look like dancers. It's like, well, they're dancing, aren't they? Part of the reason that people dance to better music and live music a lot more is because of me. Part of the reason that a lot of choreographers and dancers are out as queer is because of me. And part of the reason that people look like people is because of me. It's not single-handed. It was part of a movement of the times, you know, Bill T. Jones has always used dancers who don't look like dancers. It's like, well, what are we supposed to look like?
You have non-traditional elements in your dance, too, one of which is humor. Dancers have laughed out loud in a ballet that you've choreographed, for example. Where did that come from?
I'm funny. I'm not interested in work that has no emotional content. I don't want a neutral night out. Who wants that? You know, nobody wrote music specifically to bore you to death, although it's been tempting to think that because of how things are performed. Mm-hmm. So I like, you don't have to do any homework to see my work. You just have to be brave enough to go and watch and listen. And I hope you love it and can't resist coming back, but you might not, in which case don't. Mm. You know, if you don't like it, leave. You know, people say like, well, what do you want the audience to get? It's like, I don't know, you know, home safely. I don't know. What do you want? You know, or Balanchine famously answered, you know, what is this dance about? And he said, it's about 20 minutes. Listen and watch. That's already difficult. You know, see what happens. It won't be horrible. And I hope it's delightful and like nothing you've experienced before. That's what I want.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the choreographer Mark Morris, founder of the Mark Morris Dance Group located in Brooklyn in New York City. You did have some traditional training as you were on the West Coast, whether it was with Verla Flowers or Perry Brunson.
Right.
When did you decide you wanted to make a career of dance? And not necessarily choreography, but be a dancer.
I knew immediately that I wanted to be a dancer. When I was 17 is when I left to go abroad to travel around. My initial idiotic idea was to visit the tiniest countries only. But I went to Skopje, Macedonia, which was then, of course, part of Yugoslavia, and stayed for a number of weeks with a choreographer I'd met in Seattle who was who taught Macedonian dances and choreography. And that was incredible. And then I ended up for several months in Spain deciding if I wanted to be a professional flamenco.
So why then the switch to choreography?
I was choreographing on the side at rehearsals for everybody I was working with, which is terribly irritating.
Mm.
Now, if somebody did that now, I would just assassinate them in my company. I still call it making up dances, which people think is faux naïf, but I've always thought of it as making up dances. The first dance I made up that I still think is probably pretty good, we could do it today and it would look good. I was probably 15 or 16 when I made it up. And basically, that's what you do for the rest of your life, is the thing you did first well. I didn't know that I would be super successful. I thought I would be good, and I am.
When did that recognition happen on a larger scale that not only does Mark think he's successful, mm-hmm. but others think you're good too?
Well, I did what was then called Dance Theater Workshop, is now New York Live Arts. I performed there with my company, and then the great Harvey Lichtenstein from BAM, from Brooklyn Academy of Music, invited me to dance there. And so in 1984, the first show at Brooklyn Academy of Music was the one where it was like, oh, okay, this is actually something.
And others said, oh, okay, this is actually something.
Yeah, right. Arlene Croce being one of them, great genius critic, yeah, for the New Yorker magazine.
The BAM performance and the critical acclaim that you received very early on, that mm-hmm. was certainly a pivot point for you
right.
to become a more formal organization. And then you went to Belgium and you became the director of the...
The Théâtre de la Monnaie, the dance... My company, which then, for that stay, we were called Monet Dance Group Mark Morris.
Basically, you were the official dance group for Belgium.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that your experience in Belgium helped to put fire under your belly to create your Mark Morris Dance Center, to actually create a place in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah. It was immeasurably important. It was an incredible, very arduous and productive 3.5 years. I was in a big spotlight with some very sharp edges to it. And, of course, I had a physical plant there to work in. I had studios, and that was great. And that's when I learned that I could do that. And, of course, in Brussels, I had a giant budget and great musicians and theaters and, you know, costume shops. I could do whatever I wanted. And so coming back to New York was like, well, why not have live music all the time? Why not have a full-time studio instead of having to rent at great expense someplace that isn't very nice and have to rehearse someplace different all over town? What if dancers were following a vocation and not a hobby? And why not health insurance? And why not humane treatment of people at their jobs?
And in a way, you are pioneering this formalization or institutionalization of the dance industry. There are not many living choreographers who have their own space, have
right.
their own buildings.
Exactly.
Was there one or two people who were germane in donors in making the building happen?
Well, the genius who is Nancy Umanoff, who's the executive director of my company, I don't know how she does what she does, and I hope she doesn't know exactly what I do all the time. We got help from foundations, from the city, from the state, from everywhere, and we built a building with a lot of pro bono help and a lot of begging for money and a lot of very hard work, and we're out of space already. We have 7 studios, a school with over 1,000 kids, a program for people with Parkinson's disease. And everyone loves it when my company's on tour because they can rent the great studios and rehearse. You know, so every choreographer in town passes through my building, which for me, entertainingly, is referred to as Mark Morris. Like on the subway, I'll hear somebody, oh, God, I have another boring rehearsal at Mark Morris. I'm like, just a minute, you know.
Are you surprised by what you've become?
Well, one thing is, it's time. My parents are dead. A lot of choreographers aren't choreographing anymore. There aren't a lot of us around. And why shouldn't I have a certain amount of pull and power and decision-making capacity and represent not just dance, but people? So I'm in the place as of, you know, in my late 50s. Can it be the mid-50s? No, it's late 50s, where it's like, who's supposed to be doing this if not us? Like, why don't we grow up and do what we mean instead of complaining about what everybody else did before.
You mean we, the dance industry?
I mean we adults. I mean we late baby boom adults stop dressing like 3-year-olds and learn how to change a tire. That's what I'm saying.
You had the reputation of being brash and bossy.
Yeah, if I were a woman, you'd call me a bitch.
And how necessary, though, is bossiness to achievement?
Oh, I don't know. I could probably do this another way, but I just have this horrible personality that makes me it's sort of truth serum. You know, it's like that going back to working with somebody like Yo-Yo, like Mr. Ma, the cellist. You know, people say, what's it like? And the thing is, because he's so good, I can say, hey, Yo-Yo, you know, that's a little flat. And he will say, thank you, because who's going to tell him that? You know, so I have very strong opinions, but I don't have them in order for other people to agree with me. You know, I love a fight. I love an argument, and I love to talk about stuff.
Did you fight and argue in your home?
Not really. No. I'm daunting, and I am, of course, I'm bossy, and I get my way, and I'm fundamentally, if you look hard enough, if you squint, I'm quite kind, and I care profoundly for the people I work with.
It's just the rapper is abrasive.
Yeah, I go to the restaurant and say, the music's too loud, could you turn it down? Or the other day I was at a restaurant, and when the waiter was out of the room, I disconnected the speakers. You know, hooray, everybody applauded. So it's like, you know, you have to shave before rehearsal, but just do it. You know, it's like, I'm going to win anyway. You might as well let me do that.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Of course. It's my pleasure.
My guest has been the choreographer, Mark Morris. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8"?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers, actually, who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, what about me? You know, they manage, they go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun, but, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, oh, we're so glad you're doing this. My husband's so happy and all that. And she said, there used to be a store in Washington that closed. And I said, oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that? She said, oh, it's called the Short Men Shop. And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this, and they go, oh, really? Yeah, that sounds interesting. You know, I do okay. And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, hey, you gonna do polo shirts?
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys department.
What is a tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway signs are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched
oh, yeah.
in February
2012. Oh, yeah, we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that you're, you know, I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. Well, I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays, and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire. You know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band there. He can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's just he's a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and turned it down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day, going, oh yeah, I got the show, it's The Sopranos. I remember vividly thinking to myself, wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type. Because I thought it was, I had no idea. I mean, so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. Mm. And it kind of, you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And everyone's working for nothing in conditions that are like, you know, almost tawdry. And you sort of do it and get it on and it works. And it just, I knew, and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just, I thought, that's not going to happen again. So, you know what, let me just put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought there was no way for both of us to have really the careers that you need to have in the theater, because you have to give 110% in the theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant, and we had an incredible interview that where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, it was work, so we were, nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving, but he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. We were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer too, so she's got to sort of blaze that trail too and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia and focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who'd been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah. It's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows. And has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. There's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving in the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell bottoms anymore. And I remembered it as vividly as, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell bottoms is my rosebud. So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, 9 years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I had this mustard pair of, pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. Other 5-year-olds are not saying that. And that doesn't mean you're gay, but it was, so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, I hid it and like lots of people did and came out when I was 21 and everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, from the age of 5. How about your parents?
My mother was really, she dressed beautifully. She knew that she taught at a girls' school and she knew girls were watching, so she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, weeks and weeks on times. She always looked put together and always managed to, look great without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. It didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up. And so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to try and start this. And it's like this that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with retail. And I told her that I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They are starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands. And you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
Hmm. What bank?
M&T Bank. Mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I got started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan and I was like, we're off. Hmm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we have a proven concept and sort of real growth. And people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. And when you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur, sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it and everyone's going to live. And you know what I mean? When you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them, all of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, ooh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player. And she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit, the weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going, ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and, like, be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to, like, look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and, oh, so interested in this humanities class and, wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home, and it was all in our house. Like, one day, a truck came and delivered all these boxes, and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was. And I was like, there he is. He looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sidemen, and Sidemen being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, I sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sidemen, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of here are these things, and these sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.